Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Mike Wangpa. Today we're going to be looking at the human cost of desperation, illegal mining, migration, and state accountability in Africa, particularly, specifically South Africa. I'm joined by a very special guest, Professor Rosalind Morris. She's a professor of anthropology at Columbia University in New York. Rosalind is a Canadian anthropologist and cultural critic. Rosalind, I'm very, very pleased to have you join me today, and I look forward to a wonderful conversation.
Thank you so much for inviting me to join you. I'm very pleased to be here.
Great. Let's start off with the recent, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, there were some illegal miners that I think they're known locally as Zamazamas, that were trapped in a mine in Stilfontein in South Africa, and there was a whole lot of national and international opera relating to some dead bodies or some. So I want to use that and say, what is the scope of illegal mining in South Africa?
You know, this is a very interesting and difficult question to answer, because there are, of course, no formal statistics about the numbers of people who are involved. But we could estimate between 30 and 50,000 individuals who would be classed as Zamazamas. The word means to keep on trying or to gamble. Mm-hmm. And they basically are scavengers of ruined mines. They enter closed but unsealed shafts. There are about 6,100. Over 6,000 of these closed but unsealed shafts across the South African landscape. And, you know, that is almost the same number of people who are involved in the formal gold sector in South Africa at the moment. Hmm. But globally speaking, according to the World Gold Council, the number of people involved in illegal mining might account for as much as 80% of the whole workforce, even though it accounts for a relatively small percentage of the gold that is the unminted gold that enters the market every year, which is about roughly 20% of the total of the gold mined every year.
Hmm. So very interesting.
Large. Huh. It's huge.
Hmm. It's very huge. Yeah. It seems very, very huge. But to look at South Africa as well, South Africa is depends, a lot of its revenue depends on gold. How does this, what is the economic implication of the illegal mining on its official revenue from gold?
You know, Dr. Nwanka, but gold is a bigger idea than it is an actuality. Gold has not been the largest source of national GDP in South Africa since the 1970s.
Wow.
It is now a relatively small part of the economy, and we always knew this would be the case, because it's a finite resource. And from the earliest days of the industry, mining corporations were anticipating the time frame within which they would have to close. As recently as 5 years ago, the Chamber of Mines declared that it imagined that formal gold mining using present technological methods would more or less cease in South Africa by the 2030s. So this is an economy that has gone from a major driver of the South African economy to a relatively small part, but it still remains very large in people's imagination. And it in some ways is quite unique because unminted gold can move and enter and allow you to access things in ways that no other mineral or no other commodity can. So even though it's a small part of the formal economy, it's actually a much bigger part of the informal economy.
You've mentioned something about the finite resources. So let me just move a bit to broadly in Africa and look at Africa being one that is mainly depending on raw material and natural resources. We could see in Congo, in DRC, we could see in Ghana, many other places. So is this a warning? Is this kind of like a wake-up call to Africa to look beyond natural resources? If you look at some of these things that are like finite, like you've mentioned in terms of gold.
I mean, what people have spoken about for so long, the resource curse that supposedly afflicts Africa. You know, there are many other economies that are natural resource economies, Canada, Australia, for example. So one has to ask a little bit about, you know, why this is associated with the kinds of crises that it is in Africa. But that said, yes, every single natural resource economy is finite. And it has to be understood as part of a whole ecology of activities. The areas that you mention, especially DRC, this is also true in the Horn. These are places where there's a great deal of what, you know, we can call small-scale artisanal mining. I prefer to just speak about it as informal or illegalized mining. Is, you know, not only going to grow, but it is associated with all sorts of other phenomena, the kind of strengthening of extra state actors in the military domain, mercenary actors. And many of these are also associated with foreign powers. There's a kind of strange kind of neocolonialism that operates with these mercenary armies that are seeking increasingly not just gold. Of course, gold will always be of interest to those folk, but you know, rare earth metals, things that are necessary for new technologies and so forth. And yes, I believe exactly what you said, that the various regional bodies in Africa should look to secure their economies, but also their states and their means of providing social goods with an eye to this inevitable transformation in even if the total economy remains heavily natural resource based, locally, there will always be closure. There is going to be more and more activity of this kind.
There's something very interesting you mentioned. And that is that comes home to you know, what I do in terms of like when you're looking at the broader implication or the wider implication of how this ties into insecurity, into maybe in the terrorist group, machinery groups. And if I look at oil, for instance, if you look at the Niger Delta or the Gulf of Guinea, for instance, you look at pirates or look at all this piracy, and then you ask the question, how did they sell these oils? Who did they sell this oil to? They sell it to foreign to foreign actors. So I guess the question is, well, we're beginning to see maybe a third scramble for Africa, for instance. We could look in terms of Russia coming in with the machinery group, Wagner group in the Sahel, in Libya, and some of the attraction for them is access to all these natural resources. How do you see this playing out with this new geopolitical competition with Russia and the West in, you know?
You know, I mean, I think you named it perfectly. There is a new scramble for Africa. And unfortunately, because of the, you know, long durée of deprivation and historical evisceration of local economies and political apparatus, and the co-opting of many African elites for these purposes, there's great vulnerability. So yes, Russia, the Wagner Group, we saw devastating consequences in the Sahel, China, and various Middle Eastern states on the east coast of Africa, but China in particular is a major competitor for natural resources. resources in Africa and, you know, building enormous infrastructural projects, often extracting from local states, you know, a fair share of their sovereignty. I mean, they are operating with extraterritorial provisions, not always with local workforces. Interestingly, in Ghana, for example, you actually see in the informal sector as well, you see migrants from as far away as China working in those closed shafts or in that informal sphere. But yes, there's absolutely a scramble. And as you know, Europe is still very heavily interested in, and the United States economy is still heavily interested in those minerals, but is withdrawing politically and withdrawing its aid. And, you know, this aid is not, in my opinion, charity. This is mandatory historical recompense, you know, but.
I like that. Yeah.
That's another story, but.
Yeah, I like that you mentioned that. But I'll come to the question of Trump in a minute. But we did an episode in previously. We looked at Chinese illegal mining in Nigeria. But also you come to DRC.
Yeah.
When you come to like the green energy and the transition, it seems like China seems to be a step ahead of the United States and the West in China in terms of having some hegemony on some of those earth minerals in those places. And but then again, what we've seen before Trump, what we've seen is also we've seen some kind of like still on that competition kind of level where the U.S. is looking to maybe change its kind of principle of like human rights conditions to in order to like compete with. We recently went to a conference in Warsaw in October. Mm-hmm. So one of the participants was saying the West needs to, there's a way he put it in a very dramatic way, the West needs to deploy its whole arsenal to measure up to China in terms of going for rare earth materials. But if I come to Trump and Trump's protectionism policy, then how does that affect and withdrawal of aid or pausing aid? Do you think that is a good thing for Africa eventually in terms of what's going on? We could look at what's going on in DRC at the moment with the M23. Do you think this is necessarily a good thing or a bad thing? Because you're talking about the West withdrawing politically, but still have interest in that. How do you see Trump presidency, I guess? What impact will happen?
Well, I cannot see it as a good thing, not for anybody. But certainly the cessation, the interruption of aid, you know, there are many points of withdrawal in the United States, some of which is really kind of ideological. It's a kind of new nationalism. So this is not driven by a sense that Africa needs its sovereignty and needs to African states and people need to look after themselves. But this is the interruption of major infrastructures for the provision of social goods and material operations. This is an interruption of infrastructures that have become absolutely necessary for life in many places. So the short-term consequences could be devastating, you know, in terms of health outcomes, in terms of you know, access to things that are necessary to participate in the global economy, and you know, technological infrastructures and so forth. And it limits the scope of the choices that people can make. It makes them more vulnerable to the demand to the demands, ideological and otherwise, by other partners or other possible trading partners. I think it's really important to sort of differentiate at least three levels in this whole scene. Okay. And one is to think about the destituted poor who are so desperate. I mean, when we talk about the lives that informal miners have, especially in South Africa, very, very deep underground mines, unlike any other in Africa, but also across the whole continent. I mean, these are miserable existences. They are so minimal. They are without any capacity to plan long-term, even if they are sometimes to some people more stabilizing than say agriculture in desperate places. So you have this large population, maybe 40% of the population, that is in real deep need. Then you have, you know, they're international actors, but they're not state actors. And that would be, you know, international criminal organizations, people who traffic in gold and arms and people, And so forth. Then you have really at least maybe there are five levels. Then you have the major corporations who, since, let's say, at least since the 1990s, but probably before, but definitely since the 1990s, when we saw the beginning of the real growth in informal mining. In the 1990s, many of those multinational corporations, especially in gold, you know, began to shed labor. They were technologizing. They were also wanting to have more local labor forces and so forth. So lots of people who had depended on those jobs and who could have expected some share of the profits didn't get them, you know? Mm. So you have the major corporations and the legacies of them. Then you have local states and their complicated, you know, very different forms and so forth. Mm. And then you have the global economy. So you've also got regional blocks and power. So you have China as opposed to Russia, or perhaps in alliance with Russia against the United States. You have Europe, you have Latin America, and so forth. And then you have the global capitalist economy, which is quite indifferent to a lot of these things, but which is also creating the conditions for the growth of illegal mining. For example, the fact that there's so much demonetization, move to digital currencies, makes many people desperate for gold. And then you have this, what is another aspect of the international economy, which is massive growth in the gap between the wealthiest and the poorest. So those are many complicated factors, and they mean that you can't solve this at any very local level. And I think, people are afraid of illegal mining, or they're afraid of environmental destruction. They're afraid of their neighborhoods getting whatever, overwhelmed by folk who don't pay taxes or whatever you have it. But it's not a problem that can be solved at a local level. In my opinion, it can't be solved by, you know, criminalizing people or holding the poorest people in that whole network of factors responsible for things that are so complicated and determined by all these other major factors where there are powerful agencies. Those people at the bottom have almost no agency. And that's what we saw in Stilfontein when.
Speaking of Stilfontein, we saw how these so-called illegal miners were criminalized. But the interesting or sad thing is not even, we'll come to the government response, which is somehow, because at some level is quite abhorrent in the way the government responded to it. But looking at the level of average ordinary South African citizens and how they people seems to be disconnected from human suffering, even if those people, some of these are not nationalities of South Africa, and how they can, you know, just disconnect from it. So I wanted to look at that level, because you did mention all of these intersections of the global, the local, the regional, but how about the normal, ordinary, day-to-day human beings? No matter how have we, how did we get there? Does that tie into the xenophobic nature of South Africa? Is that peculiar to South Africa? Is that across board?
Yeah, exactly. In the South African press, if you looked at the comments section after the interview I did with Richard Poplack in the Daily Maverick, you would feel that a whole lot of people despise Zamazamas. And this has been an issue that I have been concerned with for some time. It's why I made my film, and it's a part of the reason for my book. But yes, there is widespread fear. There is enormous xenophobia that has erupted in South Africa over the last few decades in often pretty murderous violence. And, you know, this is, of course, a great sadness, not only because historically South Africans depended on support from other states, but because the mining industry demanded and coerced migration to those mines for over 100 years. And it's, you know, Francis Wilson was a great historian of labor in the mines in South Africa. And in 1972 already, he wrote and said, the worst thing that could happen in South Africa if it could shuck off the burden of apartheid is that the nation would become hostile to its neighbors and that those people who had made that industry would be treated as foreigners and excluded from the benefits. And he could see that already in 1972.
1972, wow.
And But I want to say this, you know, it's the closer that people are to the Zama-Zamas, the more complicated it gets. So people who live in those immediate communities, they often depend on that illicit gold because those people live there. Mm-hmm. They pay rents. There's lots of petty landlordism in townships and informal settlements. They purchase goods. They need fuel. Their kids, if they can find a way, go to school. They live in that community. And so many people who really know Zama-Zamas say, no, they're incredibly hard workers and they keep this place going. And if they disappear, the whole economy will collapse. Because in some places, they are the most numerous earners. They're not formal workers, but they're the most numerous earners. That's complicated because in places, you know, increasingly, it says the price of gold goes up and this becomes more and more subject to organized criminal control. It's heavily armed. These gangs are heavily armed. They're often extremely brutal, really terrifyingly brutal. You know, those communities also become vulnerable to that presence, and they don't want that. And of course, the further you get from the actualities, the more that you confuse those things. So you know, 10 years ago, the word Zama-Zama just referred to the people who go underground. But now this term is used almost to cover everyone from the lowest level person to the highest level, you know, let's just call it tsotsi, the highest level thug in the whole economy. That if you were doing an analysis of the formal gold industry, you would never say the chairman of the board and the local management and the boss are the same as the guys who are at the front, you know, chipping away at the rock face. Or the drill operators. You would never confuse all those levels, and it's imperative for us to think more complexly. But to your question about xenophobia, I would say this is the very brutal ghost of apartheid coming back.
I think another thing that there are two things that these bring up, and maybe I'll ask these two questions at once. So one is also the state of development in South Africa, South Africans' neighbors. We talk about Zimbabwe, we talk about Mozambique, and look at that. It does also talk about the state of economy and how that also impacts into people pushed by destitution. Because I've seen, compared to other region in Africa, South Africa seems to have been somehow, let's say from civil war that we could have in West Africa or military rule mostly in South Africa. So there's less of that. I don't think any South African country has experienced military rule or civil war like we had, you know, that was kind of like prevalent in West Africa. But yeah, there seems to be a lot of other drivers of it could be economy that is driving people. Basically, South Africa seems to be the destination of choice for Zimbabweans and others country, and it's putting pressure. So I wanted to speak on that on one hand, but on the other hand as well, if you look at the informal economy, which is not also peculiar to South Africa, across Africa, there seems to be a prevalence of informal economy, lack of regulations or absence of, does it speak to the absence of government in this? And how has the South African government responded to these issues? I know it's a big two questions in one, but
well, the first question, you know, those regional economies are in a bad way, and I'm not sure that one could say there was no civil war in Mozambique or Zimbabwe. Certainly, there were protracted struggles. Sometimes they fell along ethnic lines. I'm talking independently now of the question of anti-colonial struggle. But certainly, the post-colonial governments have. You know, it's a great sadness. I mean, this is, in some ways, failed revolution, post-revolutionary governments that partake of the power of the pre-revolutionary governments but don't do the work of transformation and don't ensure the equitable redistribution of access to opportunities and goods and social services and so forth. And there are different assessments of the degree to which that has succeeded. Mozambique is in a very precarious situation right now. But, of course, they lost huge sources of revenue when migrant laborers to the mine were no longer employed in those mines. So a very big piece, almost half of the mining population in South Africa was in the 70s from Mozambique. So that's a huge loss of revenue and therefore taxes and other things to Mozambique and their agricultural crises. They've suffered terribly as a result of climate-related droughts and floods and so forth. But you're right. So the question is there a lack of regulation or is there a lack of enforcement of regulation? In South Africa, I would say there's no lack of regulation. There's strong constitutional protections. There's very significant legislation demanding the rehabilitation of mines that close. There is a, you know, I mean, that country's economy has been challenged by many things. There's buckets of money in South Africa, but it is not being, you know, it's not entering into the tax base for the state to redistribute. The post-apartheid government chose to go for black capital formation and liberalization rather than redistribution in a strong sense. Enforcement has been very poor. And unfortunately, partly because of the public sentiment that you described, unfortunately, when there is enforcement, it is increasingly taking this militarized form where the police are acting in the mode of siege. They're not acting in, never mind whether this is ever fully possible, but they're not acting in the mode of preventative violence. They're not acting in the mode of law enforcement for the most part. This is a military strategy to siege. And Stilfontein is the most recent of many operations of this sort. But it was really at Orkney in November that this operation, it's called Vala Umgodi, it's close the hole, that this operation undertook the tactics of starvation, enclosure, and the deprivation of water and life support. And you have, you know, immediately you say, well, you know, why does a police force suddenly go to war? And one of the reasons is that people are treated as foreigners. You know, this is a foreign force within is how the police sees it. And a theft of national value, even though it's a really small part of national value, right? It's tiny compared to the whole economy. But it does certainly affect people's lives. Why would they do that? They think of people as foreigners, but also I think you have to recognize the complexity of the underground operation in a place with such deep mines. So in Zama-Zama mining might mean just small groups of self-organized individuals who go into a shaft for 2 or 3 days at a time. But that has become a smaller and smaller part of the total economy. And in other areas, you might have 2,000 or 3,000 people in highly organized teams who are being supplied with food, clothing, pneumatic drills, batteries, you know, the whole, now when even prostitution, you know? So if you think of how complicated an organization that is to keep several thousand people going underground, you have to understand when we talk about gangs, we don't mean a few guys with guns. We mean major organizational activity. And almost always it has to have some point of interface with the formal economy. So there was an accident in Lily Mine some years ago, a sinkhole occurred. It turned out, maybe, that one of the reasons that the mine collapsed is that some areas had been mined out illegally by Zama-Zama. But in the Commission of Inquiry report, it was found out that they weren't just Zama-Zamas, foreign miners coming in, but formal miners who were employed in that mine would go back after shift because they hadn't made enough to get their bonuses or even to make their targets. So they themselves were becoming informal miners after shift. And then it turned out that, you know, the supply was made possible by an employed person in security management whose brother was a cop, whose was involved with, you know, gangs on the surface. I mean, everyone ended up dead. But you realize this is not just a group of external pirates who are zipping in, grabbing stuff that's there. This is completely entangled with very large-scale organizational capacities. And then, you know, I will say you may understand, I don't accept this, but you may understand why the police feels it has to come, they have to come in with such complicated
approach.
Now, a complicated approach is not necessarily a cruel approach. You know, the need for a complex approach, I agree with. the idea that that means you starve people to death, that you deprive them of food, that you treat them as not human beings is not, in my opinion, acceptable under South African law or international law. And I'll leave aside the question of moral law. But it violates South African's constitutional law. And one last thing, I know I'm talking a long
time. No, but that's good.
But the people who opposed that included a very important organization, Association of Mining Affected Communities. And that's a group of mining effects. So these are local people bringing the case to constitutional court. It was community crisis organizations that tried to get food to those people just out of decency, just out of concern, because they think, yes, those are fellow human beings. And maybe they shouldn't be mining, but they shouldn't be tortured to death in this way.
So that does also give some level of hope that we have people that are humane people, because if I relate that to migration and what's going on in current terms, but I was more looking at Europe when we had the European crisis. And one of the piece that I wrote for Reese is like, we should have a humane and sensible migration policy and look at things like, we can't simplify things. We can look at things in a very broad way and look at some of the drivers, some of the things that connect to why for some want to leave where they are and then get on those dingy boats. There must be some level of deep desperation. There must be something really, we can't just neglect that. So I think that also applies in this case as well. But like you rightly mentioned, whether it's an immoral economy or an informal economy, it does also provide some sort of whatever to the communities around these places where they go. How can, so I guess the question is, how can government, is there a way to legalize or regulate or manage the artisan mining to make it in a way where people can have their integrity and yet still end, some kind of like decency and still create some kind of win-win situation? Is there a way that can be achieved?
I think that really depends on the kind of mining you're talking about. Look, there are lots of organizations and policies and state law that attempts to regulate what is artisanal mining or small-scale mining. And in some cases, that can work to the extent that it can provide a regulatory framework and safety standards can be maintained and remuneration made standard and abuses kept out, mitigated, let's say. But that wouldn't be the case in deep industrial mines. I mean, you can't make those mines safe enough. They're too large and too expensive to make that payable for a state or corporations. I mean, so that's not viable for some deep level mining. It might be okay for surface level and alluvial mining in some cases. Who administers it? How is that enforced? Is that simply a way of turning what are now informal bribes into formal taxation that these very poor people don't have the means for? All of those questions would have to be posed. My feeling is that you need what I call, massive regional economic repair, that you can't deal with these things simply within the terms of regulatory practice. And that means providing real alternative employment and or access to cash. So this would mean building climate resilient agriculture. It would mean in many parts of Africa, if to the extent that people were going to stay in mining, moving towards things like alternative energy, solar, wind, and other things. If rare earth metals are in some regards concentrated, not exclusively, but concentrated in parts of Africa, why isn't Africa manufacturing that technology that could become the basis of real economies? But it can't happen without climate resilient agriculture and decriminalizing migration or rethinking migration. Most migration in Africa isn't to Europe, it's in Africa. And so, that needs to be taken account of. I mean, globally, I think the story of the next 100 years is going to be migration, climate-based migration, and other kinds of migration. It is going to increase at exponential levels. We need to prepare for it. We need to help people think differently about it. We need to be able to have more mobile economies. Technology is making labor less human labor, less and less essential. You're going to have higher and higher rates of unemployment. Well, that's not viable. So unless you want to treat these people as absolutely disposable, you need something else. So maybe it's a combination of other economies and things like universal basic income. And, you know, that I'll tell you, that's not possible unless taxes are enforced on these mega corporations, huge oil corporations, huge tech corporations, huge media corporations. You know, we know that like the top 10 people are making most of the money in the world. That should be taxed. Like, not, that shouldn't be personal charity choices. You know, I like this philanthropy, I like that, but you got to do what I want. Universal basic income coupled with other things might be a solution. But when you propose things like use of universal basic income, lots of people say, oh, that's going to encourage laziness, you know. So one has to start thinking, everyone has to think about what one does with one's life and time. But they also say, back to your first question, well, not for people who aren't from here. You know, we'll give it to our citizens, but not that person from there. And that requires a big change in imagination, but it also, you know, won't happen if it's not made materially possible by taxing these enormously wealthy corporations and individuals. And you know what? They'll still be rich.
Yeah. You mentioned something about when you were talking about the different levels of how this is connected. You mentioned the international, the global capitalist economy. You mentioned the and then again, look, there's a professor, I think he's based in Netherlands. I was trying to get him. I've forgotten her name now. You might know her, I forgot her name. She did say that we should get to a point where no individual is making more than 10 million.
Yes, I do know who you're speaking of. And I also have to say, I also don't recall her name. She's an activist on this question. And there are a number of people, this was a big topic at the recent World Economic Forum, actually. And, you know, I'm not arguing against philanthropy or charity in and of itself, but I do agree with the argument that the taxation of these corporations and individuals is imperative if life is to become reasonable for everyone. And everyone benefits when everyone is better off. You don't have to become a kind of screaming card-carrying communist to say, I'm better if my neighbors are not living in the street and using that as a toilet, you know? I'm better if my neighbors have access to education and we can talk to each other. These days one finds oneself trying to assuage everyone's anxiety that somehow if you help the poor, their lives will be ruined. But everyone's lives will be enhanced in this way. But nonetheless, the basic fact of the matter is these corporations and these individuals make these profits because they use technology, they have access to loans, they have infrastructural capacities that are made possible by the social goods that are managed by the state. And so they owe that money. You know?
I do agree with you. And I think whatever way we look at universal basic income, we're getting to a point whereby AI is coming into place. A lot of people are going to lose their job. I was just reading, was it yesterday, with Trump trying to lay off millions of federal workers in America and then promising, you know, some 8 months cushioning effects. And then you wonder, where are those 8 million going to have, how are they going to survive? And then again, but when we look, there's another guest we brought in from Zimbabwe, and he's my colleague anyways. He was talking about capitalists that have taken over lands in that place, and then they forced people to move into Mozambique, to South Africa, and all of this stuff. So I agree with you. All of these things are interconnected, global capitalism, and how the gap between the poor and rich is you know, widening with each passing day. There needs to be more tax to to them than the diversification of the economy. But in talking about that, and specifically looking at Africa, some of the narratives that non-Western superpowers and even middle powers are using, like, oh no, we don't have this colonial relationship with Africa. We never exploited Africa like Russia. But it does seem as well, like, so you see for China, for instance, with its Belt and Road initiatives and creating infrastructures, but a lot of people also want as well, like, this in the future could be where Africans have been mortgaging their future with it. So I don't know how you see, is it better for Africa in the long run? How is diversifying its foreign relations with all of these different actors that are non-Western actors? Is that going to help?
You know, in some deep way, that's a question for people in Africa to answer, not for me. But I give you my sense. I think it's a myth that these are non-ideological, non-colonial projects. I mean, you have to just ask yourself, you know, look at the value chain. Look at the, where does the surplus go? All of, you know, capital works by colonizing, you could say, the surplus that people make. Everyone is capable of making more than what they need. And that's the nature of human life. And this surplus, you know, whatever, we make more than we need. You know, we have in some ways more than we need. You know, where does it go? Does it just turn into surplus value that can be enter into the economy, or might it become something else? But I don't see a lot of that returning to Africa. Now, you could say, well, it doesn't entail the imposition of colonial infrastructures, bureaucratic systems, schools that entail ideological interpolation. It doesn't bring curricula that alienate people from their own ways of knowing. But it also doesn't give them education, and it also doesn't give them access to the possibilities for thinking different. I mean, it's kind of, you know, Africans, stay in your place. You know, we'll build your stuff. You know, we'll be happy to participate. And I don't know. Do you see a lot of surplus?
I don't see. I think what it does, the positive I see, it gives Africa some sort of leverage to. That's just what I see. To the diversification gives a lot of leverage to be able to pull some lever, but I don't see it as a better alternative. I've never seen it. But the only positive is it allows Africa to be able to then establish their own interests, or to be able to negotiate what is of interest to Africa. So Africa can always expect Easterners to determine what is of interest. They need to be able to define what is of strategic interest to them. But it allows them the negotiation power to say, you know, we could deal with this if you don't, you know. So I could say, but to come to the last question, how do you see this illegal mining and all of this moving forward in the short, medium, and long term? What do you predict in South Africa and even elsewhere in the continent?
I believe, you know, in this, in my book, I talk about this kind of long arc of this history from 1886 to the present, and try and trace some of its ups and downs, and always against the background of the finitude of gold and the calculations of payability and the techniques and discourses of separation and separatism that it brought with it. And in some cases, I feel in the short term, this is going to be an area in which there's growth, increasing conflict, and a sensation of crisis. And as, you know, depending on what happens with the price of gold, you know, people are going to continue to look for alternative sites. In South Africa, the geology is strange, yeah? So you have gold is deposited on a very even slant from the surface of the earth. And the deepest mines are on the west rand, and the shallowest are on the east mine. The deepest mines are the newest mines. And, you know, as time went on, mining went further and further west, and these are more complicated. That's where most active mining still takes place. But as the mines close from east to west, you will see this movement of that population and people looking elsewhere. But it too is going to reach a threshold. And then you're going to have another situation, which is where, you know, first of all, many of these people are relatively mobile. They'll go to other mines in other parts of Africa. So what stays in, what starts in South Africa will go elsewhere. There's already a great deal of this activity in Zimbabwe, for example. And it is beginning to happen in other mineral economies. You know, it's already in the, of course, it's happens in coal and in diamond mining. What we see in Congo and other places where we're talking about rare earth minerals is that that is very heavily controlled by, you know, mercenary armies, militias, you know, not basically by the state. So I think it's going to be a source of real destabilization for states if they don't deal with the root issues, which is people's desperation. This one thing I would say is that at the global economic level, because, you know, various digital banking practices, cryptocurrency and so forth, everyone talks about the economy going all digital, you know, where, and you know this yourself everywhere, you know, if there's nobody has cash, and nobody has cash a lot of the time, even the guy who's taking a couple of rands to watch your car or standing at the street corner, these people have nothing. There's no way to get even anything. So there also are not jobs. Well, how do those people live? You know, this is a recipe for escalating violence, more and more theft and other things. So, you know, I really believe that regional solutions to the A, employment problem, and B, the cash problem should be taken pretty seriously. But as I said, all of this is going to be exacerbated by climate crises that are going to affect agriculture in Africa. We saw that in Zimbabwe and Mozambique. I mean, sort of breadbasket of Southern Africa is kind of depleted. And there are other sources of problems in that sector, but it's going to impel migration. And you're going to have larger and larger numbers of people who are undocumented, unwanted, without roots in places. It's frightening, you know. It is frightening. And AI is frightening. But, you know, we have capacities to prepare.
It's a good, We have
capacities to prepare. There's a lot of money in Africa.
And elsewhere.
And there is not always political will. And there is a lot of desire to get rich very fast.
Professor Morris, I really, really appreciate, like you really said, on the surface, it might look very pessimistic. But when we look, when we scratch beyond the surface, we can see that the solutions are just right there. There are measures that we can use to mitigate distance. It's not all just bleak. But I really do appreciate your very rich insight and your time. And I can already see our audience are going to like this. I really enjoyed it.
I enjoyed it too. I hope I haven't exhausted you.
No. I really enjoyed it.
These are really excellent questions that you're posing. And I hope you
Thank you very much.
I hope you can get people, you know, people with power as well as people who are just on the ground doing important, ordinary work. I hope you can get them to listen to those questions because, frankly, they are the questions that have to be addressed. You know?
Exactly. I agree with you 100%. Well, thank you very much. I'll try and get your book as well and see how to integrate that into.
I'm happy to. It's called Unstable Ground.
Unstable Ground. Oh, that'd be great. Have you got like a digital copy?
Yeah, Unstable Ground: The Lives, Deaths, and Afterlives of Gold in South Africa. It's a very big fat book, but I will have the publisher send it to you.
Oh, that'd be great. That'd be great. Yeah. Should I give you my address? Should I email it to you?
Yes, that would be super. If you send me your address, I will put you in touch with Meredith Howard. She's the promotions person at Columbia University.
That's fine. I might even review it. It might be a question of I might review it as well. But thank you very much, Professor Morris. Okay, really appreciate it.
Take good care.
You have a very good day.
You too. Take care.
Bye. Thank you for tuning in today. And as usual, join me to thank Professor Rosalind Morris for her very insightful and rich statement and rich views on illegal mining in South Africa, linked to migration and state accountability. I implore you to join me again next week for another exciting episode. For now, stay blessed and I'll see you.